next met with Dr. Kathy Miller, and to change things up a bit, we began by chatting about a big part of any investigator's life, providing second opinions on cases seen by other oncologists, which for Dr. Miller means several patients a week in clinic and many more by phone and email. To begin, I asked her in which types of clinical situations and decisions her view is often not the same as the first oncologist.
It comes up a lot on use of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting.
Right, whether to use it or not, Oncotype.
Using Oncotype, particularly in tumors over 2 centimeters, those folks with limited nodal involvement, particularly if they're younger. One of my partners just had someone in the community call and have an absolute fit because she had seen one of her patients for a second opinion. She was a woman in her early 40s. She had 1 positive node. She was actually referred for the second opinion by her surgeon, who was a bit surprised that nobody had got Oncotype on her grade 1 ER positive tumor. She had already been recommended to have chemotherapy, had a chemotherapy date scheduled, 42, 43, mm-hmm. had 1 positive node. She was seen by one of my partners at IU who talked to her about Oncotype, and they agreed this would be helpful in making their decisions. And she has a recurrence score of 6.
Wow.
And is not getting chemotherapy. And her oncologist in the community was just fit to be tied.
Yeah, I believe it.
Part of this patient's frustration was that word, the availability of the test, what we know about it and don't know about it, and any thought with her about does this apply to her situation? Is it something she would be comfortable using in her decision making? Just absolutely never came up.
Well, that's really interesting in terms of
it's
information.
Just, you have a positive node,
wow.
And the standard is you'll get chemotherapy.
Interesting.
And she was literally scheduled for her first treatment the day after that second opinion visit.
Wow. Trying to imagine what it'd be like to be that woman today. She's sitting there probably at work.
Oh, she's quite happy.
Yeah, I bet.
And she's not going back to her initial oncologist.
Wow. Okay, so that's a good one. That's one. Give me a couple other situations kind of like that where you see differences of opinion.
It comes up with radiation in the older patients, the over 70 crowd, where we also have a randomized trial for patients over 70 with ER-positive tumors looking at tiny benefits from radiation. From breast radiation after lumpectomy. We have similar instances with radiation oncologists in that area.
So you're talking about people with invasive breast cancer?
Yeah.
And the Kevin Hughes CALGB trial.
Explain to me why patients over age 70 with T1 or 2 ER-positive tumors who have lumpectomy rarely hear about that trial. What they hear is you have a lumpectomy, you get radiation, done, end of story.
Well, that's interesting. And
I've seen women who are 82 and sick who've not heard of that trial at all. What they heard, even though they tell me they asked the radiation oncologist 3 times, do I really need radiation? Because they were worried about the toxicity. They were worried about coming back and forth because they don't drive. A younger family member has to take off work to bring them.
But you see the patient as a medical oncologist, what, sort of tangentially, and then you bring up.
So they're coming to me for hormone therapy.
Right. And they go, do I really need this radiation? You go, no.
Yeah. And say, well,
and then
we can talk about
controversy
that because we do
ensues.
Have this trial. Here are the trade-offs. Radiation oncologists can look at that trial and say, absolutely, radiation works. There was a lower rate of local recurrence. The question really was, is the difference so great that that ought to be a mandate? Or was the risk of local recurrence in women who didn't have a lumpectomy in a range that some women would be quite comfortable saying, I just don't see the need at my age with my other health issues, with all of the logistics and practicalities involved. That just doesn't make sense to me.
So then there's some difference there. That's interesting. And I guess maybe the local recurrence rate you might hope might be even a little bit better nowadays. We're using longer hormonal therapy. I don't know.
Longer hormone therapy, that trial was predominantly done in an area where people would have gotten tamoxifen as their adjuvant therapy rather than an AI. So
you get the radiation.
I certainly would not expect the rates to be higher.
So then that creates some disparity in viewpoint. What are other kinds of clinical situations like
that? Hormone therapy and metastatic disease.
Hormone therapy, you mean whether to use it?
Yes.
Versus chemo.
Versus chemo.
So somebody has liver mets and they've been recommended to get chemo, mm-hmm. and you say, well, why don't you try
more? Or just bone mets and they've been recommended to get chemotherapy. I think I still, as a gross generalization, see people in the community make a shift to chemotherapy much quicker, much more readily than I would do in someone who's ER positive.
Now, I've been hearing about that one for a long, long time. And one thing maybe could part of this be the fact that now, as opposed to 20, 30 or whatever years ago, we didn't have capecitabine and that's easier on patients?
I don't think so, because it's not always capecitabine that they're getting.
Right. So people under...
And capecitabine still has more toxicity for most patients than hormone therapy.
Any other situations where you've seen more than one case where there's a disparity, the second opinion is different than the first? Any other sort of generic kinds of things come up in your mind?
I've seen three patients recently where their local oncologist has suggested they stop the trastuzumab.
Really?
Yes.
For metastatic disease?
For metastatic disease, because they've had a great response and they thought maybe it would just be a good time to take a break.
Hmm.
And I've suggested maybe not.
Were they on hormone therapy also maybe?
No.
Hmm. Stop the trastuzumab. Mm-hmm. They were on trastuzumab alone.
Yeah. So the one was a 32-year-old who presented with metastatic disease postpartum, who'd had a complete response with her chemotherapy, and trastuzumab had stopped the chemo because of cumulative toxicity and a great response and continued the trastuzumab. And she's coming up on completing a total year of trastuzumab, and they suggested that she should just stop the trastuzumab.
He said, when you suggested to restart it, which I guess she did.
Oh, she never stopped.
Oh, she was going to stop it.
Well, so she comes from a couple of hours away. So what we've been doing is she sees us. It was initially more frequently. Now every couple of months she gets treated at IU on the day of her visit with us. And then we had arranged with a local oncologist for her to get a couple of 3 weekly infusions locally so she wouldn't have to travel so far as frequently. And when she went back for her next infusion, they told her that that completed a year and would be her last one. And they essentially refused to give her any more treatments after that because it was going to be beyond a year.
So did that create friction between you and them?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? Did you actually talk to them like on the phone or by email?
Oh, I called them because the patient called in an absolute panic.
And were they okay with it or not happy about it?
They have agreed to continue.
Hmm.
I wouldn't say they're happy about it, but they've agreed to continue.
And I guess there's a bunch of reported trials that support longer treatment.
All of the trials had as their strategy continue trastuzumab at least until progression. We now have the Bamikiewicz trial and Kim Blackwell and Joseph O'Shaughnessy's randomized trial with lapatinib that says either continuing or reinstituting trastuzumab after progression on trastuzumab-based therapy improves response, improves progression-free survival, and improves overall survival. So if continuing it or restarting it improves overall survival, it seems hard not to come to the conclusion that arbitrarily stopping it would decrease survival. This woman has had absolutely no toxicity. She gets a short IV infusion every 3 weeks. It's only been a year. It's not like this is somebody who's been continuing it for 10 years and is wondering, what are we doing here? Her insurance is not balking about continuing to cover it.
Yeah, I mean, if we presented this to 50 breast cancer,
we'd have to say stopping it would decrease her survival. She is a 32-year-old woman with a young child. Why would you do that?
Well, I guess I'm just trying to figure out if the parameters that are maybe out there, because certainly anybody who kind of interacts with our programs has been hearing that message for a really long time.
And I asked him several times, I don't understand why you would recommend this. And all he kept repeating was, it's just usually my practice to give patients a break. I mean, most of the second opinions that I see, regardless of what drives them, probably 75 or 80% of the time, the recommendations that I give the patient or the way I would have treated them is the same as what they had, or they're differences that are really differences of style rather than substance. If I would have given you anastrozole and you gave them letrozole, that's not a difference. They got the same therapy.
So this 30-year-old lady I see is really looks like an interesting case. She was on one of the classic oncology trials
of
all time.
She was 23 when she was diagnosed.
Wow, she was 23.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So she was actually diagnosed when she was 23. Her breast cancer was found as part of an infertility evaluation.
So 7 years, 2005. That was just before the adjuvant trials were presented, and she was on one.
She enrolled around January of 2005. She was still getting her therapy when the trial was reported.
At ASCO that year.
Yes.
Wow. What'd she get randomized to?
So her tumor was stage 2 by virtue of one positive lymph node. She had a tumor that was ER positive, PR negative, and HER2 positive. So she had enrolled in the N9831 trial and was randomized to the concurrent arm. So she had 4 cycles of AC, then got the 12 weeks of paclitaxel with trastuzumab and continued the trastuzumab for a total of a year.
That was under your care?
Yeah.
So I guess it has been kind of interesting. She's still in treatment when the trial's reported.
Yeah, she had maybe 5 months or so to go, or
so
6 months to go on
her
trastuzumab.
She was going, yay, I got the right arm.
Yeah,
but
I actually enrolled a patient the day before the trial closed to enrollment, who was randomized to the control arm to not get trastuzumab. But then before she even finished the AC, we had the results, so she actually got the same therapy.
So, but I mean, she's a real cautionary tale here because she developed Mets.
So 7 years later, so because her tumor was ER positive, she had tamoxifen for about 5 years. At that point, stopped therapy, had a brief period of time where she and her husband contemplated trying to conceive, but with her history of infertility before her diagnosis and the passage of time and her breast cancer, they elected to adopt a baby and adopted a baby boy. She, about a year and a half after adopting their son, noticed a palpable nodule sort of at the edge of her reconstructed breast that on biopsy was recurrent disease, and by imaging she had a couple of small lung nodules that were just less than a centimeter, non-calcified, in the sort that radiologists waffle about of unclear significance. But she had had imaging with her initial diagnosis that was completely negative, so we were concerned that they were disease as well. She, at that point, enrolled on a phase 1 trial that we were doing at the time, looking at the TCH regimen, so docetaxel and carboplatin with trastuzumab with lapatinib, so a 4-drug regimen, and progressed at that first assessment. So if you look at that phase 1 trial, it enrolled 12 patients, 11 of whom responded to the therapy. She's number 12.
Just a couple of things looking at her case. One, this delayed presentation of recurrence at 7 years. Do we know more about what types of cancers? It was ER positive, but again, it was HER2 positive. Where was it?
Well, the was it becomes a tough question. We are starting to see some more delayed recurrences in the HER2 positive group. I would not say that they're common at all, but I think we've seen that difference in trajectory between the ER positive and ER negative group that are HER2 positive as well. So the late recurrences in the HER2 positive group that I've seen have almost always been ER positive as well. So I think we see a bit of a mix of the phenotype driven both by ER and by HER2. Figuring out her HER2 status has been more challenging. You know, she was HER2 positive by immunohistochemistry at our local institution when she enrolled in the N9831 trial. That trial, as you'll recall, required submission. Patients got moving with their AC while a central laboratory at Mayo verified the HER2 status, and only then did you get randomized. So we know that her tumor was also HER2 positive by the testing at Mayo. when she progressed on this four-drug regimen, we got a biopsy of the local recurrence. And by the FISH ratio, it was still positive. Her FISH ratio was 2.5. But when you looked at the details, she had almost total loss of the CEP17 in her tumor. So the total number of copies of HER2 in her tumor was just over 2. It was about 2.1. But she had less than one copy of CEP17, so the ratio looked amplified. But she really didn't have extra copies.
Did they do IHC?
They didn't have enough material to go back and repeat IHC on that biopsy of her local recurrence. We've tried a couple of times to get the HER-MARC assay on her tumor, and there were technical issues with not enough tumor and it not hybridizing. We've looked for circulating extracellular domain. That's been negative. I've talked to several of the leaders in the HER2 positive field, and they have seen only a small handful of patients like this whose ratio is positive, but driven by loss of CEP17 rather than HER2 amplification. And in those patients, they also seemed not to benefit from additional HER2-targeted therapy.
So you know she's ER-positive. You're not really sure functionally if she's HER2-positive.
I think functionally she's HER2-negative, but it's been very difficult to prove
right.
that.
Right. So maybe just bring us up to date.
So since her tumor was initially ER-positive and the repeat biopsy was also ER-positive, and other than feeling this lump, she was entirely asymptomatic. She had additional hormone therapy. She had been on tamoxifen in the adjuvant setting, but had been off for about a year and a half or almost 2 years. She has sporadic menses, so was put on an LHRH agonist and an aromatase inhibitor, and frankly progressed.
And where?
Both.
So lung the nodules, lung nodules got bigger.
Lung nodules grew to the largest one was about 1.9 centimeters. There were, in addition to the two that she had initially, there were a couple of new lung nodules that became apparent. So at that point, she switched to capecitabine with bevacizumab, to which she's had a complete response for almost 2 years now.
Capecitabine and bevacizumab. And then what happened in terms, I see she had some toxicity?
So she had a complete response, needed some dose reductions and modification of her capecitabine, and over about a year and a half of therapy, particularly the sinus mucositis and the hand-foot syndrome just became more limiting in her daily life. So we held her capecitabine, continued the bevacizumab, the hand and foot toxicity completely resolved, but the sinus issues continued to be troubling. So she has now been off the bevacizumab for, at this point, probably 2 to 3 months. Her sinus issues have completely resolved. She feels fabulous. And we actually just restarted tamoxifen, though she does not at this point have any disease to assess.
So actually, I was also flashing historically that there she is. She's 5 months on chemo trastuzumab, finds out the trial she was in was positive. She was on the good arm. You go to ASCO at the same time as the adjuvant presentations, and actually in the same session in 2005, you, with your colleague George Sledge running the session, present the ECOG study looking at paclitaxel bevacizumab. That's now been 7 years. Mm-hmm. And now she's a patient who's gotten chemo bevacizumab, in this case, capecitabine. Any kind of thoughts looking back over these 7 years? And I mean, there's so much to potentially talk about that issue. And if she should develop disease progression, are you going to want to give her Bev again?
Would I like to? Yes. Am I going to be able to? Probably not. And she was aware of that. That was something that we discussed at quite some length over several months before making the decision to stop the bevacizumab, because it was approved for breast cancer at the time she started treatment and is no longer approved. So her insurance had continued covering the bevacizumab since she had begun treatment previously and was benefiting and continuing to benefit. So we both were keenly aware that if we stopped the bevacizumab for a longer period of time than we could try to explain as a short dose modification interruption, we probably would not be able to restart it.
So we could talk a lot about Bev, but I just maybe going to ask you one thing and then let's go on to another case, which is, you know, one of the questions that's out there right now is how much difference does it make what chemo you pair it with? When you presented it was paclitaxel. I'm trying to think of how much paclitaxel Bev research I've seen since then, because we've seen a lot of other agents with Bev.
So there have been three studies that have used exactly the same paclitaxel Bev regimen, and you'll be hearing about a fourth from the CALGB at ASCO. So there are three small studies already reported, a single-arm study of between 100 and 120 patients done in Japan. And then it was the control arm in randomized phase two studies, one done by Hope Rugo, one done by John Mackey and his group. All three of those trials reported progression-free survivals of 11 months or more in the paclitaxel bevacizumab arm. There is a randomized phase three study just completed by Hope Rugo and the CALGB that also uses that as a control arm, comparing it to either nab-paclitaxel and bevacizumab or ixabepalone and bevacizumab. Those data, I understand, will be reported at ASCO in a couple of months, but what we have already heard from the CALGB is that the trial was stopped because of the data monitoring committee's assessment that neither of the two investigational arms would be superior to the paclitaxel bevacizumab arm. In the ixabepalone arm, I think the language they used was failure to be non-inferior. So I think and have always thought that the chemotherapy partner matters and plays a role in the results that we had in the E2100 trial.
And I guess the main thing there was it was probably a bigger progression-free survival advantage than was seen with other chemo?
Yes. So in absolute terms, it was a much bigger improvement in progression-free survival.
And what you're saying is like people are now looking indirectly, like you mentioned this one study of 120 people. So the CALGB study then, in other words, what you're saying is it's going to be interesting to see what progression, even though NAB wasn't better than paclitaxel or NAB-BEV wasn't better than paclitaxel-BEV, what are they going to actually see? Mm-hmm. And is it going to line up with your, close to a year, right?
Yeah. So our progression-free survival was about 11.4 months.
And in the control arm, more like half of that?
6 months.
Right. And do you think that in the long run, in terms of efficacy, I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to get this straightened out. Do you think that NAB is going to end up being kind of like paclitaxel in terms of efficacy?
No, I don't.
Think it's going to be worse?
Yes.
Really? NAB is not going to be as effective as paclitaxel.
And it's driven by different things. It has more issues with toxicity. And the benefits of chemotherapy are partly driven by how inherently effective is the drug.
More issues with toxicity with NAB than paclitaxel?
Its toxicity is very dose dependent.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The one thing about the CALGB trial that Hope has mentioned to me and other people, Edith Perez, is that maybe they used too high a dose of NAB. 150,
and they used the 150 based on the randomized phase two study that has been reported about as many times as the number of patients it enrolled.
Versus the docetaxel thing.
You got greater efficacy at 150.
But that was versus 100, right?
That was versus 100.
So I've heard people talk about 125 being less toxic, whatever. So that's interesting. But we can only go with the data we have.
Yes. And the key point is that the efficacy is always going to be a composite of how inherently effective is the drug, but also what toxicities does the drug produce that require you to limit toxicity, either by stopping entirely or attenuating doses so that you're no longer at the dose that might have the maximal efficacy if toxicity was not an issue.
In terms of nab-paclitaxel, what about patients, for example, diabetics where corticosteroids are a problem?
It is an issue for some patients, and that's truly been the only times that I use the nab-paclitaxel is when the steroids are prohibitive. But in reality, Infusion reactions to paclitaxel with cremaphore are fairly uncommon, and they typically occur with the first infusions. So we routinely start decreasing the amount of steroids we give patients after their first infusion or two, unless they've had issues with reactions. The other issue that we have to talk about with that choice is the cost.
Sure.
Nab-paclitaxel is substantially more expensive, and that does result in a greater out-of-pocket cost for patients. So if it's not clearly better in some way, I have a hard time justifying asking patients who are going to be spending a lot for their care over a long period of time, especially if you're talking about people with metastatic disease, I have a hard time justifying asking them to pay more.
Let me just ask you, since we were talking about metastatic disease, you talked about, at least in terms of the trial, exabibulin. Where does exabibulin fit into your management algorithm, metastatic disease, if at all?
I hardly ever use it.
That's kind of what I was going to guess. Is it because of toxicity?
Yeah.
I kind of think I've been hearing that, although I'm not really sure.
It's quite toxic, and that's why I hardly ever use it.
And you kind of get the feeling that maybe when the CLGB study is presented, it's going to be maybe more apparent. I don't know.
It's not going to help.
Right. What about eribulin? I'm trying to figure that one out, too.
So I've used eribulin more, and I think we are all still struggling with where it might best be used. Part of that struggle is something we deal with a lot with new drugs, because often the major trial that we have the results for when the drug's first available to us is the trial that the company did for registration purposes. And that design is often driven by the registration needs. So it tells us this is clearly an active drug, patients benefit from using it, but it really doesn't tell me where to use it and where it might best fit in. So I've used it at this point in previously treated patients, not always in patients who have all had the anthracycline taxane capecitabine that was required for entry into the EMBRACE registration trial. But I've not used it in any patients as their first therapy in metastatic disease. I know there's an interest in looking at it in that frontline setting, but I don't think we yet have a good handle on exactly where it might best fit without more data.
I certainly haven't heard the answer to that one, other than definitely what you're saying in terms of it's not first line, but because, you know, you can only go with the data you have. But
so it certainly has displaced or moved down things like fenorelbine or gemcitabine.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting.
And I'm much more commonly using eribulin in situations where I would have used those. And that is driven by the EMBRACE trial. Those were agents included in the control arm of the EMBRACE trial. So if there is a trial that says using eribulin improves response and PFS and overall survival, I have a hard time ignoring that. I have to say, I wonder if the survival is because they got eribulin at that point, or is it because if you were randomized to eribulin and you progressed, you could still get fenorelbine, gemcitabine, ixabepilone, what other therapy you
right.
not had. If you were randomized to the control arm, you couldn't get eribulin.
So
you
no
had
crossover.
Essentially one
right.
additional option of potentially effective therapy available to you. But that's a hypothesis. I don't know that that is the entire difference. So I have been using it much more frequently in situations where I would have been reaching for those agents.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, breast cancer, I guess biologically metastatic breast cancer, you do see patients who don't progress that rapidly. They get out to the fourth, fifth, you know, line
Sometimes
choices.
Sometimes sixth or seventh line choices in some patients.
But the thing that I wonder about is, because it is, in your logic, that makes sense. But, you know, is there a subset of patients, for example, who actually respond? You know, normally when I ask investigators, do you have any patients you can tell me about that you've given eribulin to, you know, usually they're picking from, like you say, a bunch of people who've gotten prior therapy. And of course, they're going to pick somebody who respond, but they do have patients who respond.
Yeah, I absolutely do have patients who've responded.
And you know, that kind of means something. You give a monotherapy to somebody and the tumor shrinks, you know. I mean, I don't know how often that happens with gemcitabine.
It does.
Yeah?
I can't give you comparative numbers, but it does happen. But the responses with any of our agents for those patients who are multiply pretreated is about 5%. So it does happen. It just is not the most common scenario.
So as usual, we got out into a tangent here, but I don't want to take any more of your time. But I will ask you just to close out by telling us about this 68-year-old lady, because that looks really interesting and different.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating lady who I picked as one of your cases because I think she makes the point that not all triple-negative breast cancer is the same. You know, we have come to, we think, know and fear triple-negative breast cancer as this incredibly aggressive, rapidly progressing, rapidly likely to kill you beast that predominantly occurs in young women. So this is a 68-year-old woman who had been diagnosed with stage 1 disease about 5 years earlier. She was treated elsewhere with adjuvant doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, which from her description to say she tolerated it poorly is an understatement.
She, GI toxicity?
Everything. She said it was just absolutely horrible, was the worst 3 months of her life, and she feels like it took her a good year after her last cycle to really recover. She is not an ill 68-year-old lady. She is otherwise quite healthy. She has typically exercised regularly. She periodically helps take care of young grandchildren. She and her husband typically go south for a month or two during the summer where she's out playing tennis and golfing. So she's a otherwise pretty healthy, not wimpy sort of 68-year-old lady. She developed fairly widespread bony metastases with no evidence of visceral or soft tissue disease.
Biopsy proven?
Biopsy proven from a bone lesion when she first presented with back pain that didn't go away.
Still triple negative?
Still triple negative. She, before I had seen her, had been treated with capecitabine, which she also tolerated fairly poorly. At the time, we had a phase 2 trial of itraconazole, and she was
what
at
that,
that point. It's the antifungal.
That's what I thought.
But it has a separate antiangiogenic activity.
Okay.
So we had a phase 2 trial of itraconazole as monotherapy in previously treated patients with breast cancer to try to capitalize on its antiangiogenic activity. At that point, she was a fan of anything that was not chemotherapy, which is really what drove her coming to see me. She has triple negative disease. She's treated in the community. Her community oncologist quite reasonably tells her chemotherapy is what I've got for you. She had a period of several months of stable disease on the itraconazole trial before she progressed. At that point, I put her on anastrozole, partly suspicious that while the pathologist said her disease was ER negative, it sure was behaving a lot more like ER-positive disease. Her initial tumor had been tested in a community laboratory several years earlier. The repeat biopsy had been retested, but that was a bone biopsy. So there are even more processing issues.
Let's backtrack 1 second. I heard this first in a lung cancer symposium we did. Question mark assays. Now, in lung cancer, it's like EGFR, that stuff.
Yeah.
But that might not be accurate in bone.
So it's a bit
biopsy.
Bigger of an issue in fish, but
fish.
The bone samples have to be decalcified as an additional step in the processing. So we have typically looked at IHC and fish results in bone as if they are positive for a marker that's likely to be true and useful information. Negative may really be negative, but it may also be some of these processing issues that increases the rate of false negativity.
ER and HER2 or just
yes.
Fish HER2?
Both.
So IHC.
Yes.
Let me just think for a second.
But
that's where this lady had her biopsy done.
Yes. So her biopsy for metastatic disease was a bone lesion because that's all she had. So if I didn't tell you her pathology and I just told you this is a 68-year-old lady
right.
diagnosed with stage 1 disease 5 years ago.
Triple
who,
negative,
who
though.
Now has fairly widespread bony metastases.
Right.
She is quite remarkably asymptomatic for what her bone scan looks like. She's had this indolent course. Triple negative is not what you would predict. You would predict that her tumor was ER positive. So we decided to take a chance on hormone therapy and say, you know, there is a rate of inaccuracy in our ER testing. And she's not sick. There's nothing rapidly out of control. Chemotherapy, she tolerates poorly and has not been very successful for her. It's behaving like ER positive disease. Let's try treating it. like ER-positive disease and see what that gets us. It sounded like a really great idea to both of us, and it got us absolutely nothing. Her disease clearly progressed. At that point, she got a painful area in her leg radiated, got back to being minimally symptomatic, and was treated with oral cyclophosphamide and methotrexate in the metronomic schedule.
If she was a person of great means, and at that point, when you gave her the cyclophosphamide, methotrexate, not liking chemo at all, she had said, I've been reading about bevacizumab. I realize I can't get it through my insurance company, but I'll pay for it.
Wouldn't have been my first choice. It's not an unreasonable option for her. It certainly has had benefit in folks with more indolent disease, with bone involvement, but it probably wouldn't have been my first choice for her.
What kind of, just diverting back out to Bev, are there situations where you really, really would like to use Bev?
Yeah, I would like to use it with paclitaxel as part of initial chemotherapy. And in most cases, whenever patients are at that point where they need initial chemotherapy with that agent, I've heard people talk about particular activity in triple negative disease, and I think they're totally misreading the data. If you look at the hazard ratios, the hazard ratio for the triple negative subset is essentially the same as for the hormone positive subset. So the proportional improvement they get is the same. But because they progress more quickly, the absolute improvement in terms of months of additional progression-free survival that you get in the triple negative patients is less than the hormone-positive patients.
So let's finish out on this lady, though. So she gets cyclophosphamide and methotrexate. Then what?
So she actually responded. Some of her mild but clearly present bone symptoms improved. Her blood counts had no issues. But over about 6 months, she started having more issues with cumulative toxicity, just mild cumulative nausea, fatigue that was just wearing on her, came to my office one day and was sort of quickly devolved into tears because she just didn't feel well. So we stopped her therapy and restaged her disease because I just was not certain if she's felt so lousy because of the therapy or because of her disease. And 3 weeks later, she felt great, and her scans showed only minor progression of her disease, really just minor progression of her bony metastasis, still no soft tissue disease, no visceral disease. And that was winter. She and her husband were leaving for their what is usually 6 weeks in a southern state within the next week, and she didn't want to go back to feeling lousy. So she went and enjoyed time on the beach and playing tennis without therapy. They actually came back 2 weeks early because her granddaughter is about to give birth to her first great-grandchild, and they thought the baby was going to be coming early, so she came home early to be there to help with the newborn. So at this point, she is electing to remain off therapy and be followed closely. And we have talked about other options for chemotherapy at the time that her disease is really symptomatically progressing and needs intervention. But at this point, she feels better off therapy and is choosing to stay that way.
How long has she been off treatment now?
We stopped her therapy in January.
So
right before she went south.
Just a few months ago.
Yeah, a few months ago before she went south.
So what are you thinking in the eventuality, let's say if she unfortunately becomes symptomatic? I mean, she really needs to have a response.
So knowing this lady, it's going to be a negotiation of the toxicities because she's had pretty miserable experiences. I'm currently thinking about vinorelbine as the first choice for her. She really is not likely to accept something that is going to cause significant alopecia. And I think that is probably the best tolerated of agents that she's not had.
So I'm wondering if there's anybody out on the roads of America listening to this or saying...
That just drove into a ditch with that choice.
No, because they... maybe have heard our recent prostate cancer program where we talked about this really cool drug, alpha-radin.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if anybody's saying, what about some kind of bone-targeted therapy like alpha-radin, which I guess you can't give in breast cancer.
We couldn't, but there are things like strontium or samarium. And
I've used those
extremely rarely, primarily because of the ongoing marrow toxicity and myelosuppression, because those agents have a nearly infinite half-life in sites of diseased bone, which for many of our patients are all the marrow-containing areas. So my reluctance to use those has been many of the patients have ongoing trouble with myelosuppression that often precludes safe administration of chemotherapy. So that has always been part of my discussion with those patients, that if we proceed down this therapy, we do so knowing that we might not be able to think about chemotherapy for you in the future. Now, for this lady, she might be okay with that trade-off because
she's not going to want chemo.
She's not had a good experience with chemo. So we may think about that option with her sooner than I typically would, especially if she's having more bony symptoms that are more widespread.
But I don't know, maybe I'm not remembering this, but I know we did a symposium on prostate cancer in San Francisco, and we were talking about alpha radin, and these are alpha rays, so they supposedly don't get the marrow, and it's hooked onto something that's like a calcium. So I was like, well, why can't you use it in other people, like people with bone mets and breast cancer? And I'm not sure I know the answer, but maybe the answer is no for some good reason. She's now had bone-only disease for a little while.
But yeah, she at this point has had metastatic disease from a triple negative primary, still confirmed to be triple negative at diagnosis for over 2 years. She has a performance status that is near zero. She says, my back gets a little achy towards the end of the day, and she takes a non-steroidal and she's fine. She doesn't require narcotics. She's fully active and does everything that she wants to do. So I think she's a great example that not all triple negative behaves in the same way. I think she's also a good example of listening to the patient and talking about the goals of therapy. She knows, and we have talked about at length, that I can't cure her of her disease. Even if she would let me slam her with the most aggressive, highest dose chemotherapy regimen I could come up with, she still has metastatic disease and I can't change that. So a lot of our decisions about her treatment have been driven by, here are the goals, here's what she wants to accomplish, what can I do that is in most keeping with those goals? And she and I have both agreed right now, what I can best do that is in keeping with those goals is not treat her.